This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That
all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
Welcome to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and it's time for our weekly recap show. I'm in the studio with Carrie Jr. II, the show's producer.
Weekly recap.
Is this the new theme? Is
I'm going to come up with something new every week until we...
we got to come up with like. Something and stick with it, right? It's different every week right now. This week, Carrie, we've got three really interesting topics to listen back to. One is about grief and how we process the loss of someone really close to us. And then we are going to listen back to two conversations about the barriers that limit democratic participation, stop people from being able to really participate in the most important part of our democracy, which is when you cast your ballot.
Let's start with voter access, and let's hop into the first part of that conversation that pertains to disability access. We spoke with Dessa Cosmo, who's the executive director of Detroit Disability Power. And that organization audited 261 polling locations, 261 polling locations across 15 different areas in southeastern Michigan. And they found that based on their criteria, 84% of those polling locations are not accessible for disabled people. And so that prevents, that creates a barrier for them in terms of being able to come out and vote.
And when we talk about the lenses we use to come up with subjects here on Created Equal, democratic participation is a huge one, right? And normally we're talking about things that are sort of passive barriers to voting.
Yeah.
Things like, clerks making sure the rolls are clean and laws that make sure that everyone who's eligible to vote can register and actually do it. But here we're talking about actual physical barriers, things that literally keep people from being able to participate in the way that they should. So, Dessa, I want to start with you. Again, my astonishment at the things you found with this audit of 261 polling locations across 15 places here in Southeast Michigan. I just want to repeat that before we get to the conversation. 84% of the polling locations were not compliant. They were not accessible. I want to start with you just telling us about the kinds of things you found in these locations that make them inaccessible to everyone.
Well, thanks for having me, Stephen. It's really good to be here. We were actually looking at four main categories in our 2022 audit, and we're doing it again in this election cycle. We started with a February presidential primary. I did it again in August, and we'll do it more in November. And these four categories are based on federal and state laws, requirements that poll places are accessible in particular ways. So none of the things that we evaluated at polling sites are, mere convenience or nice to have. They're absolutely essential to equitable access to our democracy, and they're actually written into law. So the four main categories that we evaluated were an accessible parking area with a clear accessible pathway into the building. That's the first one.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is an accessible entrance. Is the door wide enough for a wheelchair, for example, to get in? Is there a push button or is the door light enough to open with one hand? Those are two ways that a door can be accessible or not. The third category is whether or not there is a fully accessible voter assist terminal, which is what we call an accessible voting machine in Michigan. We often refer to it as a VAT, a voter assist terminal. It's the machine that someone can use to fill out a ballot, have it printed out, and then put into the tabulator if they're not able to fill out a pen and paper ballot. These are really important machines for people with physical disabilities, people who are blind, or people with learning or cognitive disabilities. And then finally, a poll site is required to have an accessible booth for casting a paper ballot privately. So that means someone like me, who is a wheelchair user, can not only park my car and safely get out, not into oncoming traffic, roll into the building, get in the door, get my ballot, and then choose between the voter assist terminal, where I can vote on the machine, or roll up to a desk that's the appropriate height for a seated person and vote privately by hand. So these are the four categories that we evaluated. And in the intro, you're absolutely right. 84% that don't meet these four requirements is outrageous, and it's really unacceptable.
Yeah. Give us a sense of the physical, I guess, condition of these places. How many are out of compliance with just one of these criteria? How many are out of compliance with three or four? I guess I'm trying to get a sense of how far we are from being able to say that you know, this works the way it should.
Right. Very good questions. And currently, we are pretty far from where we need to be. But there's really good news embedded in all of the bad news. So to your first question, 26% of all of the polling sites that we evaluated in 2022 scored no on only one of the four categories I just talked about.
Okay.
Meaning that if that one thing at that 26% of locations was fixed, we would actually have an accessibility rate of 42% across the region, which is, you know, a lot better than 16%,
yes,
but it's still insufficient.
It's still a minority of voters, right? Yeah.
It's really, it shows what a long way to go we have. However, while some of these barriers that we're talking about, I'm happy to dig into this, are about the built environment and about basically aging and crumbling infrastructure that I think all Detroiters are aware of, not just disabled Detroiters, although it does impact us more intensely. The good news is, besides that, the kind of problems that we noted in our evaluation are often game day decisions, meaning that they could have been set up a different way that was accessible, but the person setting it up didn't stop and think about it or didn't receive the proper training to do it the right way. And so those are things that don't cost money to fix or cost very little money to fix and can be done easily if we actually just have the intention to do so.
Yeah. When we think of these kinds of barriers and what they represent to people who encounter them, I think the most frightening or harrowing scenario is somebody shows up to vote on election day and they're unable to do it because the polling place is not accessible to them. Obviously, that's not the only potential outcome. I suppose, you know, people could get help to vote. There could be some accommodations made. But I want to get a sense of how frequently people are essentially just being turned away from this fundamental right because of accessibility. Do you have a sense of how many people are just not able to vote because of these things?
We do. We have some national data on that. And we have a lot of local experiences, myself included, that really show what happens, like, in real time and how it feels to be that voter, which I also think is super important because disabled people in general in this country as a group are not doing well. Like, we score very low on most quality of life indices around, you know, wealth and education and health and length of life. And yet none of that is inevitable. It all has to do with ableism and not having policies and practices in place that allow us to fully engage in our communities. Mm-hmm. And so being able to participate in the democratic process is super important to us because we have everything to gain from more political influence and more representation in government. And I can tell you, as a disabled voter, it is frustrating and demoralizing and dehumanizing to go exercise my right to vote and realize that people weren't prepared for me to show up. When they were thinking about who mattered and who they needed to set up the day for, I wasn't on their list. And that's why my organization exists. That's why Detroit Disability Power organizes disabled people and our allies to change that attitude, to educate the public, and to change the policies that are holding us back. Mm-hmm. So we don't have an answer to your question locally in terms of how many disabled voters are essentially being turned away from the process. But we do know nationally that if disabled people voted at the same rate as non-disabled peers, there would be 1.75 million more voters as part of the electorate.
Wow.
And if you think about how closely elections are won in this country, that's really significant.
It's a lot of people.
And it's a lot of people. And frankly, we are this incredibly large, mostly untapped constituency of people with a lot of common needs and common demands. And so, you know, in my view, I think in candidate, it should be in candidates' view, we are folks you want to be courting to turn out and vote.
Mm-hmm.
And if a candidate is doing that and then we show up and we can't get in the building, we have, you know, a lot of problems. So that's some national data. There's additional national data that Rutgers collects that shows that 1 in 7 disabled voters report challenges voting, which is more than twice that of non-disabled voters. So this really is an equity issue.
Yeah, yeah. Tessa, you mentioned that you have maybe experienced this problem. I wonder if you can talk about the experiences you've had trying to get access to voting places.
I can. I have two really frustrating experiences in the last 10 years. Back in 2018, I had recently moved, and so I had a new precinct, and I was really pleased when I got there that there was accessible parking. I was able to get my wheelchair out. I was able to roll into the building. I got my ballot from the nice poll workers at the table, and then I turned around to go vote, and there was nowhere that wasn't a standing height voting booth. So I would have had to fill out my ballot above my head, which I cannot do. And so I turned back to the poll worker and I said, oh, you know, where should I vote? And she looked a little confused. She moved some papers aside from where she was sitting and said, you can vote right here. And I said, well, that's very nice of you, but I'm also entitled to private voting.
Mm-hmm.
She got a little grumpy with me, didn't totally know what to do. But thankfully, another poll worker overheard the conversation and cleared off a table across the room where I could vote at the right height and in a private manner. So I was able to fill out my ballot. But as I left that day, I, again, was shaken by this sense that they didn't think that anybody in a wheelchair was going to come vote. Like, there are 129,000 disabled residents in the city of Detroit alone.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody had thought that somebody like me in a wheelchair was going to show up and exercise our right to vote. And so that's just extremely disturbing. And later that night, I had an advisory board meeting for my organization. And I was, you know, in a mood after that experience.
<I'll bet. laughs>
And I shared it with the advisory board, who, for the most part, were other disabled Detroiters of a wide variety of disabilities represented in this group. And, you know, every one of them said, Dessa, I had a similar experience. Mm. When I went to vote, I couldn't do it easily, or I wasn't able to do it. And this is what happened. And I thought, okay, well, this needs to be a major focus of the work of Detroit Disability Power, because this is not just a DESA problem. This is a systemic problem. And it seems absolutely solvable with some education and some intentionality and some advocacy. So that was 2018. That is actually what launched the collaborative poll access audit that we've been talking about.
Okay.
Fast forward to 2020, I thought, okay, let me use the voter assist terminal, which is designed for disabled voters, but can be used by anyone. You don't have to be disabled to use it. And even though I can fill out a paper ballot, I thought, let me use the voter assist terminal so I can educate myself about how it feels to use it. And I can also see if the poll worker is on their game. They were not, unfortunately. Mm. And it took them 45 minutes to figure out how to turn on the machine and get me to my ballot. I fortunately have a flexible job where I could stick around and make sure that I cast my vote. But many people wouldn't be able to do that. And so it just reiterated again that people were not prepared for people with disabilities to show up and vote.
Yeah. So it's really interesting to hear both of those in both of those stories that this was about preparation. This was about the anticipation of the poll workers and, of course, the clerks who are responsible for making sure that elections go off without a hitch. Again, your point about the anticipation that someone who has physical challenges will show up to vote. They just didn't account for that. In your estimation, is that the sort of meat of this problem? Not actual physical barrier so much as it's almost like a mental block that elections officials have.
It's really both, Stephen. You know, the way that ableism, which is the systemic oppression of people with disabilities, mm-hmm. the way that ableism shows up is that it shows up in so many ways, but it shows up in that it invisibilizes us. So even though we're at least 25% of the population, we're not thought about all that much. We're not prioritized all that much. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of out of sight, out of mind a lot, which is extremely detrimental to our well-being, and doesn't realistically reflect the real diversity of our communities if you're excluding 25% of people from being their full selves and showing up in that fullness. So there's that kind of underlying systemic problem that absolutely influences whether or not we're thought about by clerks and poll workers to the extent that we need to be. There's also, you know, other issues around aging infrastructure and the way that cities like Detroit have been disinvested in. Mm-hmm. The ways that we have so many problems around race and class and access to functional infrastructure. So it is about intentionality, and it is about disability, and it is about the built environment, but it's also a much bigger picture that all connects. So, you know, like I said, many of the problems we see at precincts are game day decisions. They're things like having an accessible entrance that then is propped open with a giant barrel that therefore makes it inaccessible, yeah. Right? Like, that's a solvable problem.
Sure.
But if you're the person trying to get in the door and there's no one there to move the barrel, what do you do? Mm. We heard this election in August, we got a call about a person in a wheelchair that showed up to vote at a church on the west side and had to crawl up 5 stairs to get in the building cast their ballot.
Wow.
That's unacceptable. That's not only humiliating, but that's dangerous.
Yes.
But that person cared so much about participating in democracy that they did that. These are people that should be, that is an awesome voter, but they should have never had to do that. But that's a person that should have been prioritized.
Yeah. That was our conversation with Dessa Cosma, Executive Director of Detroit Disability Power. That episode aired on Wednesday, August 28th. Coming up, we'll hear the other part of that conversation. We're going to talk about the digital divide and the barriers that it is erecting to voter participation. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Welcome back to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson here during our weekly recap show.
Recap. Oh, see, there we go. We got some buy-in there. So now we're going to get into the second part of the conversation. In the first segment, we revisited our conversation with Dessa Cosma and spoke about disability access. The other part of the conversation, we spoke with Christopher Ali. He researches broadband access and democracy. He's also the author of Farm Fresh Broadband, Politics of Rural Connectivity. He speaks to who has access to the internet and what that means in terms of their ability to be informed, when it comes to elections and election participation.
So, you know, here in Detroit, there are lots of people who don't have broadband internet access, even folks who have access to the internet ostensibly through their phones are just not able to do some
it's
of the same things
yeah.
that are almost necessary now to be able to participate fully in our democracy. So this conversation is not just about, rural areas, which I think most people think about when they think about internet connectivity and the digital divide, but it's really about cities and it's about poverty in cities and the way that that keeps people from being able to do these things. Christopher Ali, I want to start this part of the show talking with you about the digital divide and the barriers that it presents to voting. Let's start here. Why is the internet an essential part of democratic participation right now?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a great place to start. The internet is our window to the world right now, right? It is how we get news and information. It is how we connect with friends and family. It is how we do work. It is how we engage with many of the services, governmental services included, that we need to do on our daily basis. It's how we applied for or how we booked a COVID vaccine and how often we apply for benefits and file our taxes. It is the gateway to so much of what we do in our day-to-day lives, which is why it is essential that everyone in the United States have access to affordable, meaningful, high-speed internet.
And what kinds of things do we define as this kind of digital access? Is it as simple as having access to the internet? I mean, lots of people have phones that have some form of internet access. And then, of course, others have broadband connectivity in their home. Talk about what we're concerned with here, or the focal point of this access from a democratic standpoint.
Sure thing. So I like to think about this in terms of pillars, right? You've got, can I access a physical internet network, right? Mm-hmm. Do I have access to the internet? Mm-hmm. Can I afford access to the internet? Here in the United States, we pay more per month than anywhere else in the 38 countries that make up the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. So we pay an astronomical amount for broadband, and we know that 50 million American households and families either can't afford the internet or struggle to afford the internet because of the high costs. So we've got access, we've got affordability, and then we've also got skills and devices. Do I have the skills necessary to take advantage of my digital connectivity? Do I have a computer at home? And you'd mentioned, yes, there's a lot of folks who have access to a smartphone. In fact, over 85% of the population have access to a smartphone. That's great, but a smartphone isn't going to replace a home internet connection. And here's a great example. I'm a professor at Penn State. Imagine if I asked my students to write an essay on their smartphone, mm-hmm. right? That's going to be next to impossible. Imagine if I asked you to file your taxes on your smartphone, right? There are certain things that we can do with a smartphone. Smartphones are amazing. But to get that full digital experience, we need broadband to the home, probably with a computer or at least something more capable than a smartphone. So we've got all of these pillars. And otherwise, you know, the internet is just kind of wires in the ground unless we can afford it and we know how to use it and we have the devices and support to be able to take advantage of
yeah.
it. And tens of millions of American families don't fit with all three of these criteria.
Right, right. So how does that connect to the democratic participation we're talking about, the access to voting? What are the things that you are cut off from, I suppose, in that realm if you don't have sufficient internet access?
Sure. So one of the major things that you're cut off from is news and information. I did a study with a couple of colleagues in the organization Rebuild Local News, and we found that there are 90 counties in the United States that are what we call double deserts, counties without access to the internet and counties without a local news outlet. So in other words, these are 90 counties where you can't get access to fresh, up-to-date local news and information, or at least you got to work really hard to do it. 90 such counties. how are we supposed to make meaningful voting happen if we don't have access to local news and information? So, you know, that's number one. Studies have also shown that if you have a high-speed internet connection at your home, you're probably more likely to engage with a local elected official. You know, if we say that all politics are local and democracy begins at the local level, right, it begins with this type of communication, communication with our neighbors, communication with our elected officials, and then receiving and partaking in the news and information ecosystem. So many are barred from these essential democratic functions of to be an informed voter, to exercise our basic democratic rights, to be informed and then to vote. And without access to the internet, it makes it that much harder to do it.
Yeah. So when we talk about the digital divide, of course, I mean, that's something that affects a lot of different parts of our culture and people's participation in a number of different things. Talk about how important this is, how much impact there is from a democratic standpoint, from the digital divide. How many people are really challenged by this, and it affects the way, or I guess the efficiency with which they're able to cast ballots?
Sure. So we know that somewhere between 24 million and 42 million Americans do not have access to a broadband network. As in, they can't, even if they wanted to subscribe to the internet, they have no network in their home or their apartment that they can subscribe to.
Wow.
And that's particularly an egregious case in rural communities and on tribal land. But it doesn't mean that urban folks are also struggling. You know, there's a huge chunk of New York City that doesn't have access to the internet, for instance. So it you know, it's worse off in rural and tribal areas, but it certainly exists in urban areas as well. We also know that at least 50 million households struggle to pay for their internet subscription. And we know this because we used to have a program, the federal government used to have a program called the Affordable Connectivity Program. And that was a subsidy for broadband subscriptions for eligible households, and how you could be eligible, a household, for instance, if you had a kid who participated in a free or reduced lunch program at school, right? That made your whole household eligible. Mm-hmm. And that was $30 a month, or $75 a month if you lived on tribal land. 50 million households were eligible for that program, and at the end, about 23 million actually subscribed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we know that at least 50 million households are struggling to afford their internet subscription or just can't at all. And I've heard from folks who have told me, you know, in surveys that I've had access to, hey, I'm debating if I can afford food or my internet right now.
Wow.
Right? That is awful. And then what we don't really have a collective number on is the tens of millions of folks who don't have the confidence, the digital confidence, to really take advantage of their internet connections, right? They may not have the skills, they may not have the devices, they may not have the support to be able to do this. And again, if you don't know how to use your computer, it's just a brick.
Yeah.
It's a brick
right.
Sucking up electricity.
Right.
And so we've got these three. What I can tell you is that the National Digital Skills Coalition found that 92% of jobs will require digital training in some capacity. And so this goes back to ideas of digital confidence, digital literacy. There's a great term that Professor Sharon Strover uses at the University of Texas called digital dignity. And I love these ideas because it's helping folks achieve whatever it is that they want to achieve. Mm-hmm. And voting, of course, and being an informed voter is one of those essential pillars.
Yeah. So Christopher, what do we do about this? I mean, as I said in the open, I feel like in some ways the digital divide is getting a little worse. I mean, technology is moving really fast forward, and there are lots of things that are kind of developing. And it feels like the people who are left behind are being left further behind every time something else develops that makes it easier for those who do have internet connectivity. So what, I guess, makes you optimistic or gives you hope about the idea that we can bridge this divide and get more people to be able to participate?
Absolutely. So I think one of the first things to understand about the digital divide is that it's actually less about technology access and broadband access than it is about power and inequality.
Hmm.
I mean, the communities that are most likely to be marginalized in this country, low-income communities, BIPOC communities, justice-impacted individuals, newcomers to the country, non-English language speakers. All of these communities that are more likely to be marginalized in any other capacity are more likely to be on the wrong side of these digital divides, right? So the digital divide to truly confront it also means confronting the amount of structural inequality that exists in this country. That's point one. So it's a much larger, sort of a much larger conversation. But to get to the, you know, to drill down to the things that are making me optimistic are what I'm seeing happening in communities across the country. I really do think that the way forward, the way through these digital divides is going to happen at the local community level. I mean, librarians are the heroes of digital literacy, right? They're the ones day in and day out working with folks on how to use a computer, how to build a resume, right? How to surf the internet safely. Shout out to every single librarian. I was in the city of Pittsburgh a few weeks ago, and the housing authority there, thanks to some foundation giving, created what they call a cyber bus that drives around to low-income neighborhoods and offers a very powerful hotspot in addition to computer training, which is just an amazing use of community resources. Mm-hmm. In Virginia, Albemarle County, Virginia, has recognized how important affordable broadband is, and so they've allocated county funds to offsetting broadband subscriptions for low-income households. So all of this is happening at the local level, and this is what I love to see, because this is really, I think, going back to the whole point of our conversation about where democracy begins. Mm-hmm. It begins at the community and local level, and this is that stuff that I love to see. At the federal level, we are about to see the largest investment in telecommunications in the country's history rollout. It's a $42 billion program called the BEAD program, the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program. And that's going to go to hopefully bringing fiber optic connectivity to folks across the country. And then we've got another $2.75 billion dedicated to what's called digital equity and inclusion. And that goes to things like workforce development and education and digital skills and digital confidence. So there's some big money coming down the pipes in the next few years, which hopefully these communities are going to be able to take advantage of.
Yeah. That was Christopher Ali, a researcher and the author of Farm Fresh Broadband, Politics of Rural Connectivity. That episode aired on Wednesday, August 28th. Coming up, we're going to revisit a conversation about how to move through grief. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Welcome back to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with Carrie Jr. II, the show's producer. Up next, Carrie, we're going to listen back to a conversation I really enjoyed with Laurie Tucker Sullivan, who is a journalist and an author. She's written a book titled I Can't Remember If I Cried, and it is about interviews with widows of rock musicians about how they processed the grief of losing their loved one and how they were able to kind of piece their lives back together and move on.
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, Stephen, listening to you and Lori have that conversation, it felt very much like you were Terry Gross and this was a fresh air episode. The tone was, I think it was gentle, and it was definitely like kind of an intimate conversation you two had about this topic. And what I think Lori brings in her book is really helpful, because it's not just about losing someone, right? And the trials of losing someone. Yes, that is a big part of it. But I think what she outlines in her book and talks about from her experience of losing, even having lost her husband, is she learned how to move through it from these women's stories. Mm-hmm. And their stories are very complicated, with the relationship between the band members and financial. I think there's legal battles and a lot of things that make the grieving process complicated for them. But through it all, they've kind of persevered and found how to define their own story on the other side.
Yeah. Lori, I want to talk a little about that title, that it comes at least in part from the Don McLean song "American Pie," which I have to say I know as a closing song in bars, right? In the 1980s and 90s. I shouldn't say 80s because I wasn't legally allowed to be in bars in 80s, even though I was. But, you know, as the hour approached 2 a.m. or whenever the place was supposed to stop selling liquor and send everybody home, they would put that song on and everyone would sing at the top of their lungs. And it's this very long narrative that that has a lot of historical references, and it really occupies a place in not just rock history, but kind of American history, I think, in the way that yes. that story is told. But I wonder what you make of that lyric. I mean, there's something very sad about that lyric, and there's something very sad about that part of the song. Why did you choose it for the book?
Well, the full line is, "I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride." And it's about Maria Elena Holly, who is the widow of Buddy Holly, and I believe the first rock widow. And Maria Elena doesn't talk to too many people these days, so I did approach her and was not able to get an interview. But, you know, she was pregnant at that time and heard about his death on the radio mm-hmm. and subsequently lost their child. Mm. And so I think she is also a symbol of what all of these women still go through. It happened again in the 70s with Ronnie Van Zant and Lynyrd Skynyrd. It happened, you know, since then it has happened. And now in the age of getting the story first and getting it, you know, out on the internet, it's impossible to prevent it. There were guidelines that went into place to try to prevent that from happening after Buddy Holly's death. Mm-hmm. And now I think those have just really gone out the window. So it's something that these women still battle. And she's kind of a symbol of that, the start of it.
Yeah. And you were talking in the earlier segment about the need that women feel to just go on and continue to manage life and continue to manage other people's lives after they lose a spouse. This lyric kind of points to that in some way. I can't remember if I cried. This idea of kind of soldiering on and moving past these things without appropriate time for grief.
Yes, yes. And I think, too, the lyric, you know, is really from the point of view of a fan saying that he can't remember if mm-hmm. he cried when he heard about this. Mm-hmm. And that opens up a whole new area of discussion of how these women deal with fans who are quite often obtrusive and cross lines and feel they have some ownership and some right to memories or to, you know, or to actual possessions of these people. So yeah, there's that too. But yeah, it really, the lyric kind of came to me and I wanted to use it as the epigraph in the book and I still didn't have a title. And then I thought, that is the title.
That's so title. Common that the thing you're looking for is actually right in front
there.
Of you.
Yes.
It's just doing something else right. than what you imagined it could. I do want to talk a lot about the women that you chose for the book. And let's start with how you chose them. Were these women whose stories had spoken to you before, or did they jump out at you because of what you were trying to do here?
A combination of those. So I first made the list of musicians and rock stars that had died at a young age that were married or had a partner. Mm-hmm. And then I started looking into them. And in some instances, they were out there because they had their own careers, their own lives. Gloria Jones is an example of that. And again, prioritized them a little bit around those people whose music was important to me and to us, and wanting to hear those stories. So I think the first four or five that I did were Gloria, Peggy Sue, Honeyman Scott, Crystal Zevon, and Sandy Chapin, mm-hmm. And a kind of combination of, you know, I knew that Sandy had worked very hard to preserve Harry's legacy and all of the work that he did. He was, you know, known at the time of his death as much for his work in building up nonprofits and preventing hunger and things like that as he was as a musician. And so that was of interest to me. And once I started kind of digging a little and finding their stories, you know, it was, again, I knew that these were stories that needed to be out there, needed to be told.
Yeah. So let's talk, let's start talking about Crystal Zevon, who you've already mentioned, and what defines, I guess, or drives her struggle with grief after her husband, who's not her husband when he dies,
right.
does pass away.
Yeah. You know, they had a difficult marriage. There was physical abuse within that marriage, but there was also this lasting love at first sight. And neither of them remarried after they divorced. She moved away from him to kind of start all over and let him deal with things. But then as soon as he was given a stage 4 diagnosis, he called her and asked her to care for him.
Yeah.
And that's not uncommon, actually, for people who have separated or divorced to come back together when death is imminent. Mm-hmm. And so she kind of had to wrestle with that. Did she really want to go back and get involved with him? And he did start drinking again. He made his last album that, you know, he really willed himself to live through making that album and seeing his grandchildren born. And then he asked her before he died to write his biography. And in doing so, she had to go through boxes and boxes of journals that he wrote throughout his life. Mm-hmm. And he wrote about, you know, the kind of mustard that he had on a sandwich. And he also wrote about her, and he wrote about his affairs. And he, you know, it was very difficult. One of the most poignant lines, I think, in the book is when she says reading his journals was like getting punched in the face all over again. Mm-hmm. And then after, you know, when she read them all, she realized that it was also his one last ask for forgiveness, his one last kind of request for absolution. And it was a gift that she gave herself to do that for him.
What do you mean by that?
He's not here, you yeah. know, so she can be angry with him forever. Mm-hmm. But being at peace with him and with their life was the better thing for her.
Was for her.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a lot to forgive.
It is. It is. I think for so many people in relationships, that's some part of the grieving process is coming to the space where you can forgive the person, maybe just for leaving, even.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Has that been some of what you've had to contend with?
Personally, mm-hmm. myself, mm-hmm. a little bit. I mean, I think my anger is more directed at the universe for that. But there are certainly times when I think about where I'm at and how different it would be if I still had my partner here. There are many times when I'm out with friends and I'm the seventh person in the group. And, you know, those times are few and far between. I think I'm, you know, doing pretty well. But yes, there is that anger that sometimes is hard to even place. Why did this happen to us? You know, I had a husband who was young, who was healthy, he ran marathons, and yet he developed a smoker's cancer, which, you know, how did that happen?
Right. An incredible unfairness.
Yes, there is. For many, many people.
Who are some of the other women who you think kind of stand out in the book? I've got a list too, but I want to give you a chance to highlight some of the ones that really matter to you.
Gretchen Parsons Carpenter mattered a lot. Graham's music was something that Kevin and I had discovered. I still remember we took a trip, just the two of us, to Toronto, and we were in a music store, and I picked up a CD of a tribute CD to Graham, and there were musicians on that tribute CD that I recognized, and so I thought, I'll try this and take a listen, and that, you know, led us down the path to listening to his music, and so I was very interested in talking with her, but she had never spoken to anyone, and she makes very clear that this is her story, and she's not going to wade into the mess that other people have made. And so she was the second or third interview that I did. I went to her home. Here we are on the patio overlooking Laurel Canyon, and it's just a beautiful setting. And again, I learned these lessons from her, and learned, first of all, how very young she was, how young Graham was. Here's a 20-year-old woman, young woman who meets this man at a party for the Rolling Stones that she kind of wanders into as a fluke. You know, a friend is there and calls her over, and he's gorgeous. He's wealthy. He's Harvard educated, at least for a year, and then he dropped out. He's in a band. He writes wonderful music. He's, you know, musically close to a genius, and very charismatic. And they become a couple, and then he becomes a heroin addict, essentially. And she is left at, you know, 21, 22 to cope with all of this. Mm-hmm. And since his death, has become kind of known as the jealous wife who, she's blamed for things that at the time, my children were in their early 20s. And I thought, neither of them, I have a son and a daughter, neither of them could cope with this.
Sure.
And I have a friend who is a journalist who, when I told her Gretchen was one of the people I interviewed, she said, you know, she's kind of always been the Widow Parsons. Like, she has never quite moved on from this. And then she read the chapter and she said, I owe her an apology. Hmm. I can't imagine now being that young, being pulled into this life and having to deal with it all. And then trying your best to move on, and she's been quite successful at that. But circumstance pulls her back into this because he has become the thing of legend.
Yes. That was my conversation with Lori Tucker Sullivan about her book, I Can't Remember If I Cried. That episode aired on Monday, August 26th. So that'll do it for our recap this week.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to say real quick, what a title for that book.
Yeah, I love that title. It's such a great line in that song by Don McLean.
Yeah. The fact that life just goes on and you can't pause it to spend time to really
feel this pressure to not stop.
Right.
And to keep going and to keep everything kind of together. Mm-hmm. And I think women in particular feel that pressure in a way that men sometimes even don't. I mean, it is a very gendered experience because of the institutions of sexism in our culture. So,
especially when you're in the spotlight like that too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. If your business cares about civil conversations, about equity, about opportunity in our community, Created Equal is the place that we're having conversations like that. Your sponsorship of this program will keep those conversations going and expand our ability to have them. You can sponsor this program at wdet.org/sponsorship. That'll do it for this edition of Created Equal. Remember, you can listen to recent episodes of the show at WDET.org. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe and to rate the show. You can also leave us a review. If you like what you hear from our WDET programming, please support the station. We are always taking donations. And to do that, you just head over to our website and click the donate button at the very top of the page. It is next to the red heart. Created Equal is produced by Kerry Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Our digital team is David Kim, Jenny Sherman, and Sophia Joswiak. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.